One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. We're all still in isolation. I'm wearing old, ill-fitting clothes and have a scratchy, non-becoming beard. So no difference there. Thea is with me via the wonders of technology. Thea, how are you?
I'm all right. Same, bar the beard.
Bar the beard. Good to hear that. How's your foot?
It's improving, actually. In the past few days, I have been much more mobile, not that I have anywhere to go.
You're not allowed for your 1.5-hour sanctioned walk? Or
I have been to the field at the end of the road, yeah, to take the dog.
That's nice.
I felt very emotional.
Did you? Was it one of those things where...
Well, it was the first time I'd left the house in a month, so... Or more, in fact, almost 5 weeks. So, yeah, it's amazing.
I do partly feel that I've evolved into something that can handle this. Because I was saying to my wife that apart from not going to work, my life hasn't changed that much. Because I'm either working or looking after my children, and then I stay in at night anyway. It's not like my vast social life has not been reduced a tremendous amount by this.
Well, and we'll see in symposium that we come to talk about in a bit, a lot of people say that their lives haven't changed all that much. I think it's Gabriel Dzibovici says that writers are by their very nature self-isolators. So it feels much the same to him. Although I think Sarah Moss in her contribution disproves the kind of the universal theory of that. Pine for people.
Yeah, I don't pine for people at all. Now, before we move on, that's true. I want to do food thing. Because I think I've been asking a lot of unhealthy questions each week. I want to have a healthy question for you, Thea. You can only take one vegetable into quarantine. What will it be?
Well, we've sort of alluded to this in previous episodes. And I know you're about to tell me it's a fruit, but the tomato, yeah. I consume
You're so Italian, aren't you?
But also, I mean, because that is technically a fruit. I don't know.
Am I allowed sweet?
Like a long-stem broccoli. Just the one.
Do you? Yeah, you've got to space it out. Am I allowed sweet corn?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
How
do you have it?
Well, I have it in tins, obviously, Thea, but I mean, I quite like it roasted. I think sweet corn is...
I love it on the cob.
Yeah, I like it on the cob. Do you know my other theory about vegetables? Anything with red peppers in is kind of inherently childish.
Nothing did you say like your other great theory about vegetables is though?
Yes. I can't even think what the first theory is, actually. No, anything with red peppers in is childish. Like, who eats red peppers apart from raw in salad? No one.
Well, what about in gazpacho, which quite often has red pepper in it?
Yeah, all right.
That's
all
a very adult dish.
Yeah, I don't like it. Do you like it?
I do.
Yeah, you're so sophisticated. Yeah, okay. We've established you're sophisticated and I'm a provincial prole. But anyway, we've got a couple of things I want to get to. People have been tweeting where they're from. Christopher Patton in Jakarta and Catherine Sharp, who comes from the UK and is now in Quebec, Canada. So I do like the thought of people listening to us all over the world. Do tweet us your location at @FBFM_podcast or at Stig Abel or at @Thea_LeonardDootsie or at the TLS or any way you like. And someone's emailed us, Thea. I mentioned, I think it was probably with Lucia, a thing I did with my family where we all pick a painting out of 1,001 paintings to see before you die and we all redraw it. And we've been doing that this week, actually. Anyway, Heather and Jordan from Yorkshire gave it a go and sent us a picture and they did Caravaggio. And it was really good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was very impressive.
And it also had two beers in it, the photo. Did you see that? I thought that was...
It did. Well, apparently, yes, and they were... Are we allowed to give a brand name? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
they were Corona Beer, which is apparently incredibly cheap at the moment, which is funny and just absurd.
Yeah, so drink a Corona Beer. I reckon you should do it, because you can draw, can't you?
I can draw certain things. I can draw animals. I'm not so good at humans. I mean,
okay, well, have a go. It's really good fun. Get a picture, a famous painting, and redraw it.
Okay.
I've done it various times. I mean, mine looks just like someone's had a stroke.
I haven't seen any of yours. I'll have to look them up. Are they all on Twitter?
No. A private thing.
But
people can
make
them public. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, if people send it to us. Here's my email address if you want to send you a redrawing of a famous picture. stig.able@the-tls.co.uk. They're all very cheering. Right, a couple of other things. You should be subscribing to the TLS if you listen to this podcast. If you're not, use this code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. Thea coughing suspiciously there. If you notice any time anyone coughs, everyone go, oh, God. Do you that? If your fellow coughs, you go, oh, you're okay.
Nervous look.
Okay, that was just a throat clear, was it?
That was. I didn't know how to get away from the microphone because it's sort of taped to me. Yeah. Wrapped up in wires.
Oh my God. Anyway, concentrate. Podcast offer, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. Best price anywhere on the internet. Please do subscribe. This week, we've asked a friend of this podcast, Dr. Zan van Tulleken, to write about his take on coronavirus and the medical political response to it. He'll be on hand to tell us what to think. And we did a little bit of this last week, but we've got several TLS contributors to share their secrets of self-isolation, what they're reading and watching and listening to. Lucy Dallas will be here to go through them all. So it's extraordinary when you think of it how quickly we've adjusted to the new normal. A couple of months ago, we'd grouse at the weather if it kept us inside, longing for spring and freedom. Well, that spring will now never come. Instead, we have to contemplate a world of lockdown and economic shutdown as countries around the world struggle to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. And in this, we are all observers and agents, and we've had to become amateur epidemiologists.
I was ready to help.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's Zan Tulleken not helping there, and he's not an epidemiologist, but he is a doctor with a specialty in public health and a long-standing reader and contributor to the TLS. And in the last couple of weeks, his expertise has grown. He made a documentary about the coronavirus and then, going beyond the call of duty, actually caught it himself. He's also, along with supermarket workers, the only one who seems to be professionally enhanced by the coronavirus. Because he's on the telly all the time talking about it. But he is on the podcast as well with us now. Zan, hello.
It's lovely to be here. In fact, I'm meant to be on the telly all the time, and I've been so poorly that I haven't been able to. But I was fibbing to my mother about being well, and my twin brother, who I had sent to do the telly programme for me, which is live on BBC One every morning, mentioned that I was very unwell and had to get to hospital. And my mother then saw this and was absolutely livid. So having a twin brother isn't always an advantage, but I am on the mend now, which is very good.
Did you have it? Yeah.
So I sort of had two problems, really. One was the reason that I think I had the coronavirus, I've not had a positive test, but the reason I think I had it is partly because I had a high temperature, really felt dreadful, and had a hacking cough. But I also completely lost my sense of taste and smell without having nasal congestion. And so, and that seems to be, depending on what you read, about 30% of cases. And it's a very, very, very peculiar symptom because, I mean, we know it does happen with some other viruses, but it's unusual. And I mean, I could eat a spoonful of Coleman's mustard and I could be eating wallpaper paste. You feel nothing. Very odd.
And is that still there, even after you've recovered elsewhere?
It's gradually returning, but food was very peculiarly joyless. And the other thing, my twin brother is an infectious disease doctor and is on the coronavirus wards at the moment in London. And I was phoning him in tears repeatedly. And I wasn't, you know, I felt very ill, but I mean, I had a very mild case compared to many people. And he said, you know, I think there is some central effect, by which I mean your brain, your mood is also affected by the virus, because I wasn't feeling exactly, I didn't have anything specifically to be tearful about, but we'd phone him in floods of tears quite regularly. And our poor mum has had the same problem. So, yeah, I don't know, you know, but we're still, it's very strange. It's a new illness. So we're still trying to figure out how to describe it and what it means to everybody.
And then you went to hospital yesterday with something else.
Well, there do also seem to be some cardiac effects. And I had a thing called atrial fibrillation. And I woke up in the morning and thought, you know, I haven't practiced as a doctor for a few years now. But when you learn to take pulses, you learn to look for them being regular. And in fact, you want them to be regularly regular. So there are a few pulses which might go boom, 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 and they'd be regularly irregular. But I just had a chaos pulse, which is atrial fibrillation. So I went in and I have to say, I had a real cry at how extraordinary, I'm forgive me for burdening your cliche-free podcast with this, but with the NHS in the space of maybe the sort of 4 or 5 hours that I was there, probably 20 people cared for me really meaningfully and profoundly and made me well and did all sorts of complicated stuff and just took care of me. And I felt completely overwhelmed by it. It was really, I mean, it's obvious, right? I worked for the NHS for 10 years. I never spent any time on the wards crying about what a brilliant job we were all doing, but it does feel quite emotional being there at the moment. And there are some very, very poorly people coming in alongside me.
And so how optimistic are you, Zan? Because how do you feel about things? Because you've spoken to the chief medical officer just before he got ill. He may have given it to you or you may have given it to him. You've been in hospital yesterday. You've seen the wards. Your brother works in hospital. Are you feeling like a lot of the noises coming out of government is that it's going to be bad, but it's going to be manageable? Is that kind of how you sort of read it as well?
My anxiety, as you say, so I made this documentary and so I got to interview people who would not normally necessarily pick up the phone to me. I met Chris Whitty, although we didn't interview him for the programme, but I did have a long chat with Jenny Harries, who is the Deputy Chief Medical Officer and really an extraordinary person as well. And then a ton of other virologists and epidemiologists and so on, all of whom are deeply and directly involved. And my anxiety was I had begun to worry that there might be no plan. And I think lots of people felt that as these measures, first it was no herd immunity, then it was herd immunity, then we moved away from herd immunity again, all these sorts of things. And I think the communication has maybe not been brilliant. But in fact, as soon as I set foot in the Department of Health and Social Care, you could immediately say, oh, no, this is clearly, we have some of the best people in the world working on this in the UK. They have been working on it for many years. We have had a plan. It is impossibly difficult. There is no plan that could make this virus not have a terrible, terrible lasting effect on people's health and on the economy. But I think the anxiety that maybe it's just chaos in government and they're making it up from day to day, that is not in any way the sense I have, despite the many shortcomings of the response.
Part of the plan, as I understand it, is for the most vulnerable, the elderly and those with severe underlying health conditions to stay in for 12 weeks. How realistic is that? And then how do you sort of weigh that against the toll on their mental health of staying in for that kind of amount of time?
I think the most difficult thing about our response to this is that for everything you do to reduce someone's risk of getting coronavirus, you increase their risk of something else that you cannot win. And so my poor parents, I just delivered some groceries to them. Of course, you know, everything we do to keep them safe is devastating for their physical and their mental health. I mean, it's really, really dismal to be older, you know, they're not at the end of their lives, but I mean, my father's over 80, my mother's in her 70s. And you think, well, how many years have we got left and how many of them are going to have to spend locked up one of our remaining summers? I mean, I feel like I'm going to lose a whole summer out of my life. And, you know, hopefully I'll have a few more to go. So I think it's very, very tough on people. And the other thing that's very striking is that there are some people who are going to be much, much more affected than others. And for some people, it's impossible to do this. I mean, that's the thing in all the commentary about the selfish people going walking on Dartmoor or whatever, the, you know, these people who haven't been taking the rules seriously. We are asking people to totally, totally upend their lives. And I think for some people, that's impossible. If you live at the top of a tower block and you've got four kids who need a ton of care and you're trying to work two jobs and, you know, there are people who just cannot do what the government is asking them to do without effects on their family that are so devastating, it becomes untenable. And so I think the other very strong sense I had talking to people in Department of Health and Social Care and in Public Health England is we all have to remember we are trying to slow the spread of a virus that we will almost all inevitably get. And so it's like we're all tied to the tracks and the best we can do is slow the train down. And slowing the train down is really important. But the sort of guilt and the fastidiousness, there's that Catholic sin of scrupulousness where you're sort of so obsessed with the minutiae, you forget the basics of sort of the Bible's teaching, you know, be nice to poor people and you're obsessed with how many kinds of material your clothes are made out of or something. And I think there's a danger of that kind of thing where we're so obsessed with the 2 meter rule that we're forgetting a sort of maybe a generosity, a general intent to slow the spread of a virus.
Do you think the problem is also there's a kind of zealotry on both sides? There's a certain type of argument which is just lockdown, and lockdown is completely safe. There are no consequences to locking down other than stopping the spread of the virus, and therefore anyone who doesn't exactly embrace lockdown is a traitor. That's one extreme view. And the other view is the kind of Trumpian view, is get the economy going at all costs because ultimately the economy makes everyone's lives better. But realistically, for everyone, including the government, it is trying to find a point on the spectrum between those two things that is manageable, isn't it? Because ultimately, if you destroy the economy, people will die. If you lock people up for 3 months, people will die. People will have irredeemable breakdowns. If you don't let any, if you allow people to romp around the streets, people will die. And there has to be a point on a spectrum we hit here, rather than there is an absolute answer either way.
I think you're absolutely right. I guess the metaphor I used in the piece I wrote for you is this kind of I used to fly small planes at university. I was a very, very bad pilot, but this the thing that I was most frightened of, which was a mistake I managed to never make, was bouncing the landing. If you bounce a little plane, your inclination is to go, oh my God, you know, you're airborne again. You don't want to be airborne. You want to be on the runway. So you think, I'm going to put the nose down and get it back. But the plane has already slowed down, is already heading towards the runway again. And you pile it into the runway and bounce even higher. You then overcorrect and eventually you drive the nose into the ground. And it's usually sort of not fatal, but really, really embarrassing and terrible for the airplane. And so, And we're trying to control an oscillating system, right? As we push down the lockdown, we get fewer deaths from coronavirus, but we're going to create all these other disastrous consequences. But they're all further down the line. So as we compensate for one thing and we wait the sort of 4 to 6 weeks for the deaths to fall, so the other things start to escalate. And we really don't want to be in an oscillating system. So the government, as you say, is trying to thread the needle. And I think all the, you know, through Brexit, I think there was a lot of criticism of the sort of the centrists. I always feel like you've been a vocal and enthusiastic centrist. But in fact, we are trying to find a centre ground. And I guess the sense I have at the moment is it's a new tool. And this first bit of the lockdown is figuring out what the cost is and what the benefit is, and we're trying to explore how to make it work. And without getting into a big oscillation, how do we ease it up? What are the most important parts of the model, and how well do our models work compared to the actual true life experience of it? And so I think in 12 weeks, we're going to have massive amounts more data from testing. We're going to have a much clearer idea of the economic effects, and we will begin to work towards maybe not something as harsh as a cost per life saved, but we'll begin to get enough metrics that we can start to make the kind of decisions we would normally make in healthcare about what response is proportionate.
Zan, you mentioned the or we've both sort of mentioned sort of reactions on social media. What do you think of the coverage generally in terms of media and social media of the pandemic? Are you gnashing your teeth at it, or do you think it's been fair?
There's a few things that are sort of surprising, where every time I see a headline saying largest ever increase, you think, but that's the nature of it, right? It's a doubling thing. Every increase will always be the largest for quite a while. It's an exponential curve. And so there are a few things where I think, come on, there's a lovely graph I've seen online of the exponential curve of how much time people are spending looking at exponential curves. But yeah, but I think in general, I mean, maybe with the exception of Peter Hitchens sort of really banging the drum and that the Telegraph sort of the end of freedom, that kind of stuff, where these are very reasonable public health measures that are being taken in a state of emergency to save lives. You know, I think you have to be a really real polemicist to try and work this into a loss of freedom that's permanent. Basically, I suppose I've been quite impressed by it. I mean, if you think that every single person in the country is involved in a massively complex new bit of public health, and the media have managed to effectively communicate the basics of that to people, I think that's quite impressive. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that seems quite good to me.
I wrote a thing for the Times generally where we all beat ourselves up the whole time. Have we not kind of handled this pretty well? You know, no, there's been no mass violence on the streets. There's been no, you know, people have voluntarily accepted the complete reversal of their lives. And more or less done so with good grace. That feels like a success to a certain extent.
And I think the difficulty is, I mean, you know, we saw in Sierra Leone, in West Africa during the Ebola epidemic, what happens as people start to really feel the pressure of a lockdown and we do get unrest. I mean, we're only 2 weeks in. And while there are people who live absolutely hand to mouth day to day, a lot of people in the UK can get through 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. You know, people like me have a bigger cushion, but eventually everyone starts to go, is this worth it? What are we achieving? And I think there's going to be a really, really odd shift where we are going to feel a massive economic squeeze in many households, coupled with, in the same household, people who are incredibly vulnerable, dying and potentially being refused care or at least getting suboptimal care. And I think what we're going to see start to play out on the news is both things rising quite simultaneously. The tsunami has not yet hit in terms of what is about to happen in our intensive care units and in our hospitals and in that Florence Nightingale Centre in the XL Centre. It's going to be a very big deal. And there is not one ventilator per bed in that XL Centre by a long way. So great to provide the care, but without staff, a bed is not that valuable. You know, most of the care for this will happen, people looking after themselves at home. So I think I remain cautiously optimistic. I think as long as the supermarkets are selling food and the key workers can work and some people are able to travel a bit and the police are not too draconian, I think we'll get through it. But I think we are, the next 12 weeks, I think will become very difficult for a period of time. Sorry to be gloomy.
Oh, I've been speaking quite regularly to my aunt in Italy, who's a nurse, and my cousin, her son, is also a nurse, and he's working on one of the wards. So every time I speak to them, they just keep on saying, you know, it's still to come, a few more weeks and you'll be where we are. And there is that sense of, while trying to be optimistic and doing everything that we can, obviously, to avoid overwhelming the NHS, there does also come the point that you have to accept that the NHS will be overwhelmed. So you're kind of both things at the same time.
Yes. But the NHS will be overwhelmed and a lot of people will go bankrupt and have massive financial problems. And I think my sense, is the sense you're getting from Italy that what was initially a great deal of public support for the lockdown and these scenes of solidarity of people singing and things like that, that has become maybe less cheerful and more of a grind as time has gone on?
That still seems to be high. I mean, pride in the National Health Service there is really strong. Ours is much younger than yours, than the NHS, I mean. But the pride and the good spirit, the goodwill is still very much there. We have, in Italy, you hang the tricolour flag out of your window if you have someone who's working, you know, on the front line. And that's across the nation. Everyone's still doing that. And we're still doing all of the clappings and stuff like we're doing now in the UK as well. So I think the feeling is still good, is still positive, and people are still doing their bit. But yeah, I absolutely agree that there's a... there's a limit to how long people can do that, and there has to be some valves in the system. There has to be a bit of give just to keep everyone going, I suppose.
But they've also, presumably, there's got, you know, we're talking about this, Zand, as if nothing is going to be advanced outside of managing deaths in the course of this. But we've got to believe, have we not, or is this a kind of horrible naivety on my part, that better testing will take place, so there'll be a sense of people who've had it, who'll be probably immune, who can play a greater role in society. A vaccine, Johnson & Johnson are saying, could be online by January. There'll be developments in how people are treated. There'll be developments in how people are tested. There must be an argument that while all this management's going on, the greatest scientific industrial brains in the world will also be working at ways to ameliorate it artificially.
I don't really know how to manage optimism in with sort of unknown things. I'm not sure about that. So I suppose here's the danger with those things. First of all, we have been trying. The common cold is enormously expensive to the economy, and we have four circulating coronaviruses that have been going around for a long time in our in human populations, and we have never invented a vaccine. Not only that, but if you catch one of them, you are not rendered immune even to that same one a year later. So not all coronaviruses are the same. It may be that the vaccine can be developed that will provoke a greater immune response, or at least one that lasts long enough to slow the spread. But even so, there are reasons to be pessimistic that the other coronaviruses do not seem to be vaccines against themselves, which it has proved. And there are some, well, there are many viruses that we have been unable to create vaccines for. Dengue fever, HIV, that they are not vaccines. When the disease is not a vaccine against itself, it's very hard to create a vaccine. So that's one note of caution. The other thing is it's very hard to do this stuff. With the testing, I it would be very surprising if we did not get accurate, rapid testing fairly soon. But it is very hard to exaggerate the difficulty of doing that, right? So at the moment, the test is looking for a little piece of genetic material. And the nice thing about genetic material is it wants to amplify itself. It wants to make copies of itself. And that's what the test relies on. So you take a tiny, tiny bit of it from a swab, and you can make it balloon in this PCR machines. And then you can run it out in a gel and look for it. But the rapid test will be looking for antibodies, and antibodies cross-react famously. Viruses that create antibodies, those antibodies can then go on and do other things in your body, and they can also look like antibodies to other illnesses. And so they can be very, very difficult to make perfect tests for those things as well. I think that the antibody test, I'd be pretty optimistic that we will have those soon. But 12 weeks for that is a very, very, very big ask. I mean, if you're think of the number of tests we need and how accurate they have to be, and what it would mean to have a test that is 90% accurate as opposed to 100% accurate, which would be much more likely that it will have a significant false positive and false negative rate. What that will mean for people's management is very significant. So I would be cautious about saying the scientists are going to work this out. In general, public health is still, you know, hand washing, distancing, isolation of cases, those sorts of things are still going to play a very, very big part in the control of this going forwards.
We could talk to you forever about this, Zan, but we probably shouldn't do. One point I want to add before I ask you what you're reading and listening to. If this had happened in, say, 1905 or 1870, would there this COVID outbreak, and people would have less understanding, there's a lot of deaths happening, would it have left a mark on the historical record in the same way that the Spanish flu obviously did? Although, interestingly, not really much of a mark on the literary record, which is the thing we had a letter in the paper about this week. And nor did the Black Death, interestingly. Chaucer barely mentions the Black Death. It just became part of life, and therefore he didn't write about it. I'm just interested, if, as a thought experiment, if this had happened in another time in history, would people be writing about this coughing fit, or would it just be seen as part of the general malaise of life?
Well, sadly, I think we're going to get an answer to that question, because there are large parts of the world that are effectively living in another time in history in terms of access to healthcare. And so in Africa, There are countries which have reported zero cases because they have zero tests. I think it's in Ghana. I was speaking to a friend of mine who works on the region for the United Nations, and she said, I think it was Ghana has more members of the cabinet than it does ventilators in the entire country. I mean, it is really, really going to be difficult. And so the metaphors, I mean, I think what the way that we think about illness is through metaphor always, that we're never fully understanding it. And so there are diseases that, if you've never heard of an illness and you get diagnosed with it, the first thing that people do is go, well, I don't know what neurofibromatosis type 2 is. What's it like? What can I compare it to? Is it like having, is this going to be like diabetes or like HIV or a thing that I've read about in the newspaper? Whereas if you get diagnosed with a well-known cancer like breast cancer, even though that will mean different things to different people and will have very different effects on them, we still have a general understanding of how to feel about that illness, if you know what I mean. And we don't have that at the moment. And I suspect that's what leaves its mark on the historical record, is the metaphors of illness that we use. So, I mean, Susan Sontag famously wrote about HIV and its metaphors and tuberculosis and its metaphors, whether a disease is considered enlightening, a disease of poets, or whether it's a disease of extreme poverty, or what it means in different communities. And we're still working on that. And I suspect that will determine how this is perceived. But I have a feeling that in many parts of the world, as we saw with the unrest in India with the shutdown, many people will go, no, we are living so much closer to the edge and we are already affected by so many other diseases that are very, very severe, that this is just one more thing and will leave a massive footprint in terms of death and suffering. But maybe on people's minds, it will just be one more problem.
Well, shall we finish with, I know you've been playing with a squirrel who you've trained, which is a little bit Counter Monte Cristo, but there you go. What apart from that are you doing? Because we're talking about books and podcasts or music or films. What are you reading or watching or listening to, Zan, that you would share with us?
I've been rereading Wolf Hall, and I'm now on to Bring Up the Bodies. And I was reading the fever scene in Wolf Hall where he has malaria. And he says, he reassures them that the king comes to visit him at Austin Friars. But it's the most amazing description of a fever and the weird sort of waking dreams that you have and these sorts of things. So I really enjoyed that. And of course, the plague keeps carrying people off through the book.
And the sweating so sickness.
I mean, it's a completely... it's strange because the first time I read it, I don't remember that as being a very dominant feature of the book, but it, over and over again, it comes up. So that's been some very good, I mean, those books are quite accessible in a way. They're quite, they're sort of barnstorming in a way. I mean, although they, I think it's fair to call them literary fiction, they're pretty enjoyable. So that's been good. In terms of listening, I usually, because I live alone, I've got an audiobook on. At the moment, I'm listening to The Hare with the Amber Eyes by Edmund Dewall, which I'm quite into Japanese ceramics. And everyone always says, you've got to read it. It's one of those books that was on my shelf. And so rather than read it, I thought I'd get it as an audiobook, which I'm really enjoying.
Zan, thank you so much for joining us today. You've written this lovely piece for the TLS, and I feel we've just peppered you with medical questions, and you've been very patient in answering.
No, look, lovely to speak to some other humans, and particularly you two.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If self-isolation and social distancing are to a degree synonymous with sensory deprivation, a shutting out of the world, there's also a clear element of intensification about it, being at home all the time, where everything, your whole world, seems channeled and concentrated, for many of us, around the kitchen table, with the very idea of a work-life balance alive only in the memory, along with abundantly stocked supermarkets and too close conversations around a pub table. Our homes are now also offices, schoolrooms, playgrounds, gyms. So we at the TLS wondered, how is everyone coping, culturally speaking? We asked a selection of our contributors, and the results are surprising, reassuring, and in some cases even inspiring. In those cases, look up your local bookshop and they're likely to be delivering. And yet, Dinah Birch points out, our new lives may be isolated, but they are not peaceful. I found that an increasing flow of emails and messages and calls leaves surprisingly little time for contemplation. For Claire Carlisle, everything changed when the schools closed and I became a full-time mother, housekeeper and governess. While some people face the opposite problem, time to myself, she says, is suddenly as scarce as pasta and hand sanitizer. Lucy Dallas joins us on the line now to help us through the results of this little symposium that we've done. Hello, Lucy.
Hi.
I'm wondering just briefly if you, Lucy, have, like a number of our contributors, been reading Hilary Mantel's latest, The Mirror and the Light.
Well, in fact, I have already read it.
Oh, pre-isolation.
Yeah, about 3 weeks earlier than I should have. I would have loved to have had it to save it up, but I read it because I chose the extract that we put in the paper.
Ah.
And I think it really is actually the perfect book to have when you've got a bit of time and you want to be really immersed in another world.
My mother-in-law's reading it at the minute, and she says she found it quite hard to start with. And I think the thing about Mantel generally is it's you have to really get into it. So I'm not sure how... I've seen quite a lot of people say on social media they're having trouble concentrating at the minute. And I think the idea that you can just sit quietly and read loads of books is almost a fantasy. I think people's minds are a bit too febrile sometimes for books that take a while to get into.
Sarah Moss says, in fact, that she's finding it a bit too much at times. She says she's... she, as in Hilary Mantel, is managing the shadow of the end so brilliantly I can't quite bear it last thing at night, for example, which you can see.
Yes, and I agree with that, Stig. I can understand that sentiment. I think if you know that you love the Hilary Mantel already, let's say you've read the first two, you know the style and you know the world, I think that would make it much easier. But as for, you know, sort of beginning to read War and Peace or learning another language, I think that needs so much brain capacity and, as you say, concentration, that actually, certainly for me, that's not where I'm at, sadly, at the moment.
Margaret Drabble, meanwhile, is continuing apace with her German lessons.
Again, if you were all right at it already, I would have thought a good bit of German grammar you could get really stuck into if you have the discipline.
Indeed.
I think the world is divided between people with young children and people without young children in this place. Because I'm very struck by Emily Wilson, the way she talks about how she's watching cartoons with her child, as well as trying to translate the Iliad. And my baby, I've got a two-year-old, she's awake from 6:30 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night with a two-hour gap in the middle of the day to sleep. So if I'm not working, that's what my job is, looking after that baby and two other children. So I think there'll be loads of people who won't be doing anything other than childcare and trying to keep sane, let alone reading, you know, reading German or anything like that.
Yes, and I think I was going to say, actually, I was going to make that point for quite a lot of the contributors in the piece. You can see that there are some people who work alone quite a lot anyway and who maybe, you know, haven't got kids in the house. And they're able to, sounds like they're able to concentrate on things and, you know, do serious work. And then the people who've got kids in the house are kind of saying, well, that's what I'm doing. And in the few moments that I'm not doing that, you know, I've got time to think about cooking or music or something like that.
Well, and I'm wondering, I mean, for both sorts of people, I suppose, but especially those whose moments alone and unbothered are fewer, whether a particular form seems better suited than others. I think Dinah Birch mentions that she's turning to shorter forms, songs, sonnets, short stories for, you know, those snatches of time.
Yes, I think that's again very noble. I'm not reading sonnets. I tried to remember one the other day when I was, I think, showing off to my children about Shakespeare, and I couldn't even remember the first line and a half.
I read all of the sonnets last year for that book I was writing, and I was, because I'd never really read them, Shakespeare sonnets these are, and I was really struck by how whiny and creepy and stalkerish they are. And either that means Shakespeare was a sort of helpless, moaning stalker, or he was creating a sort of pseudo-Hamlet character that he was voicing in these sonnets. Because when you read them all in a row, they have these moments of sort of fleeting beauty, but taken as a whole, they're quite creepy. They're not particularly romantic. I mean, the Dark Lady sonnets aren't romantic at all, and the other ones have this sort of endless moaning quality to them. I find it really quite striking when I read them again. I wouldn't turn to them for consolation now, I don't think.
I wonder also, in the sonnets, it's more like a singular persona, isn't it? Whereas in the plays, you have, you know, all the people that he's voicing and bringing to life. Whereas in the sonnets, it's much more, as you say, it's sort of, I mean, without being too reductive, he has sort of got a one-track mind in it.
Yeah, that is very, very true. Have you been listening to music? Will Eaves talks a lot about music in his sort of cultural diary. Are you listening to a lot of music?
Yes, and we're all trying to listen to all sorts of different music, and also it's a nice way of not listening to the news. And Will talks about, he's been buying records from the charity shop, which sounds like a brilliant charity shop. And he's talking about two people, David Munro, who founded the Early Music Consort of London. So he was very much into really quite early music, kind of 14th century. And a pianist called Paul Jacobs, who recorded 20th century solo music, very, very difficult stuff, Messiaen, Stravinsky. And they both died quite young. And Will writes beautifully about how much he's found in both of them, and how it sort of intersects together.
Rather unbelievably, Will says he was not aware that Henry VIII had a collection of 25 crumhorns, apparently unplayed, or that the word itself, meaning curved horn, first crops up on an organ stop in Dresden in 1489, which frankly I thought everyone knew.
Yeah, for God's sake, I'm...
Will
Eaves might be listening to Henry VIII's crumhorns. I've started listening to Green Day with my 8-year-old son.
Oh, my God.
And he absolutely loves Green Day. He thinks there's swearing in it, which he likes. But he's really getting into his sort of American punk.
It's a good stepping stone record, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, also the early stuff, because I remember growing up with Green Day, but the you know, American Idiot and stuff like that's almost a rock opera. Anyway, because we've got guitars in the house, so we might start a programme of me trying to teach them guitar, which could end absolutely horribly. You could imagine that.
Isn't Lee Child doing something similar?
Lee Child is listening to people playing Fender Stratocaster. He's listening to, I think he says Dave Gilmour and who's the other guy? I think, is it Jeff Beck? He's very keen on the Stratocaster, so he's that's what he's listening to. That sounds to me like that you should start a family band.
Let's come back to Larry Wolfe. He's got his contribution's quite lovely. There's the music, but there's also a really lovely bit on his family and sort of the way that he's connecting with his 90-year-old father, who he obviously can't be with.
Yes, this is someone else who's kind of immersed in music. So he's written for us quite a bit, Larry Wolfe, written lovely pieces about going to see live shows at the Met, the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And obviously this is now closed down. So he's been watching the nightly streamings, because they're streaming performances that they've done before, and he's listening to them at the same time, I think, as his father, who he says has been subscribing to the Met, I think that's what you call it, for 50 years, he says. So his father is really missing going to the opera, but they're watching these streamings at the same time, and comparing notes. And Larry's talking about he's watching performances by Dmitri Vorostsovsky, who was a wonderful Russian Verdi baritone, really, who died in 2017. And he had brain cancer, and he still performed after his diagnosis. So he's talking about a particular performance he gave when he was back at the Met, and he had got this diagnosis, and he was singing with Anna Trebko, which is a dream casting anyway, really, in Trovatore. And so he's talking to his dad about how wonderful they are, and his dad's saying, "Whoa, you should have seen Zinka Milanoff and Leonard Warren, you know, a long time before that." So that's a lovely way of comparing and communicating through music.
Go on. Okay, so whose isolation would you safely invade, Lucy?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, how do you just knock on the door? Is that the thing?
Well, I suppose
your isolation.
A mask and gloves and all of the, if you know, some kind of bubble helmet.
My feeling is we shouldn't, I'm talking about taking over their isolation. I don't think we should share it with them. I think we should just
like
assume their isolation.
Bump them
yes.
out.
Yes, yes, that's what I'm, because if I go first, I would definitely bump off Lee Child.
Of course
and make
you would.
Him move. I'd move him back to. He can move back to one of his other houses, because he lives in Wyoming, in the middle of nowhere, and he's got he's looking at YouTube on guitars. He's reading for the Booker Prize, so he's reading loads of novels. He's watching a bit of telly, looking at a few guitars in what I imagine is a giant mansion in the middle of nowhere in Wyoming, which is pretty much my fantasy life anyway. So I am knocking off Lee Child, sending him somewhere else and stealing his isolation.
Right, it's yours. Done. Granted.
Yeah, thank you. Lucy?
Well, I would go, I think, for Emily Wilson, because she's been watching with her kids Avatar, The Last Airbender, on Nickelodeon, which is absolutely brilliant.
Is
so
it?
So I would welcome any chance to watch that again.
Would my kids like that, Lucy? How old is it for? Would my kids like it?
Oh, well, it's. I think it's for any age. Yeah, they would. It's highly recommended. And then I think she's a Booker Prize judge as well, isn't she? So she's got all the novels to read as well. So that's what she sort of, you know, got to do. And then, but also, she says in the evening when she has got time to work, she's working on her translation of the Iliad.
We're all doing that, Lucy.
Well, I've rather neglected mine recently, yeah. And I feel like that would be a brilliant thing to do. I know enough Greek to know how bad I am at it, and I would love to be completely kind of immersed in that world, because I think that really would take you somewhere else. But also, as she says, there's a lot of parallels about death and suffering and privilege and all sorts of things. So that's who I would take. How about you, Thea?
I was going to. So this fictional stealing of other people's isolation means that we also acquire that person's faculties.
No, that's good.
An ability to translate the Iliad. Yeah. But I would steal Claire Carlisle's isolation. I think her high-low balance seems good to me. She goes from watching 1970s Columbo, which she says is stylish, funny and subversive, to reading Spinoza's Ethics, which she says offers deep drafts of clear, refreshing reason, while his Stoic insights feel therapeutic as well as too true. And she quotes him that human power is very limited and infinitely surpassed by the power of external causes. Nevertheless, we shall bear calmly those things which happen to us contrary to our advantage if we are conscious that we have done our duty and that we are a part of the whole of nature whose order we follow. So that
very
sort
wise.
Of sends shivers down the spine. And also, I haven't read Tove Ditlevsen's The Copenhagen Trilogy. I haven't read that, and she recommends it, and it does sound very me. So I'd like to think that she would sanitise her copies and pass them over. It was apparently initially rubbished in the 1960s when it was published for being too working class and female, which does sound very me.
There's far too much of that about. There's far too much of that about now, though, Thea. Too much, too female, too working class. Spinoza is, of course, Jeeves' favourite philosopher.
Yes,
of course.
I think, as I think we all know,
George Eliot's, I think.
Yeah, well, they're very similar people. I wonder, Thea, if If we were to observe you in your house and there's Columbo...
You can't,
about
can
to
you?
Go on the... No, I can't, no. But if you had 2 hours... 2 hours to kill, you're watching Columbo, not reading Spinoza, I feel, Thea.
Oh,
you can
for
talk,
sure.
You can talk a good... Yeah, you can talk a good game now.
But exactly. I'll just be watching ER and the reruns of all of... I discovered that all of the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes, the whole series from the 80s is online. So that's the next thing that will end me.
Oh, that's good. That's, do you know what we were talking about, whether it's hard, how hard it is to sort of get into new things? I am, as you both know, all about the rereading. And I think rereading in a time of corona is really important because you can sort of find places to go back to. You have that sort of comfort. So I'm still rereading Caleb Carr's The Alienist, which is one of the great crime and historical fiction novels ever. And it's set in turn of the century New York, and it's about a forensic scientist, the first ever forensic scientist, tracking down a psychopath. And it's magnificent. So what I've been doing is reread a bit of that, and I've been reading a book called A Distant Mirror, which is about the 14th century and the Black Death. And it really does put what we're going through into massive perspective, because the 14th century really was absolutely awful.
Oh, God. I mean, people's heads were bleeding out in the street. So, yes.
But also the weather was really bad. Europe's population more than halved.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of wars going on. But when you look at actually the reaction to... the Black Death, there are occasional moments which make you think. There's a great bit where she says, and people thought everyone's personalities and morals would change when the Black Death left, but they didn't. And I think all of us kind of believe after the lockdown's over, we'll all be better people, all sharing and experiencing life together more happily. And of course we won't. It'll all be the same.
We can still hope.
Go on, Lucy. So Thea's watching crap TV. I'm rereading books. What are you doing?
I'd like to be... translating the Iliad. I'm not yet. So a couple of people had said that they were also reading cookery books, which I quite like. I like either like reading cookery or gardening books. Don't say anything, Fig. We're all different. We all have different interests, more than an interest. Because I like reading about something quite practical and then doing it if you can. That's quite a good antidote to feeling fidgety. And I'm wondering if it's too early in terms of rereading, because I read it again quite recently, to read A Place of Greater Safety, which is another Hilary Mantel, even bigger, I think, maybe, than The Mirror and the Light. That was about the French Revolution, and it's terrific.
I mean, really, we're all the people who counselled against hoarding books, as I imagine we have all done, regardless of that advice. This is the time. This is vindication at last.
Yeah,
there's
I don't
just
feel
no
that
risk
I have
of
to
running
go,
out.
No, I don't feel I have to go out and buy loads of books, because I've still got loads in my house that I want to read or read again. I feel fairly comfortable I could be shut in for a couple of years and I'd be all right for books.
But it's true that I'm still finding it difficult to not, you know, I am what you said earlier, Stig, about the flitting of the mind. I am still compulsively watching the news. So even while I sat down to be high-minded and watch a stream of a live theatre production from earlier in the year, Cypress Avenue, I watched so much of it, and then I realised that it was 10 o'clock and I had to watch the news. And I know you can watch it, you can watch it after it started, but there's just this compulsion to get it on time as it's happening, along with whoever else in the country may be watching it. Do you feel that?
I feel that one of the great things we should all do for our mental health is pick a time and stop at like 8 o'clock at night and stop consuming all news after that point. Someone tweeted me, which I thought was great advice, was pretend it's 1970 and just get news first thing in the morning and once in the evening.
Yeah.
And don't try and do any more than that, because nothing's really going to happen. like pointlessly scrolling through deaths in Lombardy on that, and you know that there's that FT, very good FT graph showing tracking deaths. It's all very expert and correct and laudable, but it's going to precisely not make me feel better about myself or my life. And I think to a certain extent, it's all our duties to look after ourselves. And to me, that is finding something comforting to watch on telly or to read about or to listen to. Because you can't change any of this stuff. There's no point in knowing too much about it.
Mm. Well, there you go. I've told you. Jeremy Brett, Sherlock Holmes. It's all online, Stig.
Done. Done. Done, done, done. Lucy, you look after yourself. We'll speak to you again soon.
OK, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Lucy Dallas and Zan Van Tulliken. Next week, the paper includes a piece on a Victorian scandal involving lesbians, morphine and a blind pederastic vicar. That'll take our mind off things. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.